Welcome, and thank you for joining our discussion about the Rural Evidence Review Project. This conversation is in response to the online survey that had 1,500 people across 211 rural BC communities talk about their healthcare needs and priorities. I'm Jensen Shields, and I'm joined with the principal investigator, Jude Cordelson, who is the associate professor at the Department of Family Practice at the University of British Columbia. I'm also joined by research coordinator, Christine Carthew, also at the Center for Rural Health Research at the Department of Family Practice at UBC. We will begin our conversation with Jude. How did you get this project started?
Yeah, so I've had a history of doing some, well, I guess they're reviews, evidence reviews for the Ministry of Health and health authorities and BC Women's Hospital. And I recognized that the data and evidence, rightly so, is often in the hands of the decision makers, which they need to move forward with their planning process. But communities have a strong voice and a strong and clear sense of what needs to happen at a local level. And they often don't have data and evidence at their fingertips in the same way. So it's not really a level playing field when they go to advocate. Mm-hmm. So we received funding from the SPOR unit, which is the Strategic Patient-Oriented Research Unit in BC, which is funded by the Canadian Institutes of Health Research and the province. And it's all about involving and engaging in a meaningful and authentic way citizen patients as partners in the research we're doing in healthcare.
Okay.
So we received funding on the basis of wanting to take citizen patient community direction in what evidence is needed. So to do that, we had to backtrack a little bit and ask communities what their priorities around health services are. And then we would do this nice translation into a research question, and it would then end up into a research answer, which would be translated again into a policy answer or a advocacy answer. So the survey we did is actually just a small part of what we do through the Rural Evidence Review Project. And Christine can tell you a little bit more about some of the evidence reviews, but we were mostly doing the background to know which evidence reviews were going to be of value.
Okay.
So we put the survey out, and we were very, we were fairly casual saying, okay, it'll be great to see how many responses we get. And oh heavens, within a week or two, we had 600 responses.
Wow.
So right away we stopped and went, okay, we need to do this in a more systematic, research-oriented way, because although this data will certainly be so valuable for our evidence review process, we think it's also really valuable for advocacy for healthcare and decision makers, for communities to advocate based on provincial priorities. Mm-hmm. So we paused it. We got organized. We redid some of the questions a little bit and re-administered it to then end up with over 1,500 surveys responses, which is just wonderful. So I'll just emphasize the breadth of the response across rural BC has been fantastic, all the way up to the northeast in Atlin, to the northwest in Atlin, to the southeast in the Kootenays, East Kootenays, and everywhere in between, including the islands and remote island communities. So we've had really great reach across the province, which of course makes it really exciting, because we feel that we're closer to being able to, although mindful of not homogenizing what rural BC wants, to understand provincial priorities.
Okay. And Christine, how did you get involved in this project? Have you worked with Jude in the past?
Great question. I came onto the project, like Jude said, the survey is a component of a larger project, which is called the Rural Evidence Review. And I came onto the project just over 2 years ago. And actually, the initial survey that Jude mentioned, which was originally just to try to understand priorities for our evidence reviews, had already been created. But I've been with the project since it's evolved into a study of its own, where we are now very interested in understanding these priorities to then share with policymakers. So I've been with it throughout this burst of engagement, I guess you could say.
Mm-hmm.
But this project is my first time working with Jude. Yeah, so it's very exciting.
Excellent. We mentioned that there was a lot of people responding to it, but one thing I find very fascinating is A, more than 75% are female, and that of the respondents, there's 133 people that work in healthcare, and they're majority nurses. It seems like we've got a lot of nurses kind of advocating or at least participating in this survey, kind of because they're the boots on the ground.
Yeah, agreed. And that's been a really exciting part of it too, is the number of healthcare providers that responded. We weren't really reaching out to the providers. We were really focused on the more generic citizen patients in rural communities. So we're just in the process of analyzing the healthcare results. And it's really interesting that there's such a strong commitment to maintaining access to care for rural communities from everybody involved. It's really interesting to go around to the communities. We do a lot of field work, and we always talk to mayor and council and people in elected positions. And healthcare is always such a huge priority for the rural communities.
Okay. And one of the main things I'm noticing here is rural communities, at least individually, a lot of times don't really have the care that everybody needs. So there's a need for transportation. For example, a lot of people in Creston have to go to Cranbrook or Trail just to get quite basic things handled. Not to say our hospital doesn't have most of what we need, but there's a lot of things that we just don't have access to. So people are in need of rides, and there's no Greyhound anymore. And even if there was a ride, the roads are so dangerous. So people are stuck, essentially, in our communities, and it's becoming an issue. I'm kind of going off the rails here, but isn't it the government's responsibility to provide essential service? And wouldn't transportation be an essential service, especially for those who are in need of medical care?
So that's an excellent question. And I think it's something that the province is grappling with right now with the health authorities. And, you know, with the notable gap that the reduction or elimination of the Greyhound bus service has left rural Canada with, I think we do have to come up with some solutions. And you've hit the nail on the head regarding the questions we need to ask. So we do a pretty good job in BC with emergency medical transport through BC Ambulance Service. We're really lucky to have them, notwithstanding the challenges that are unavoidable due to weather and things like that, the geographic challenges. But there's a little bit of a gap in who needs to step up for the non-urgent but healthcare-related transport. And the question I've been asking is, whose responsibility is it? Is it actually part of the medical system's responsibility, or is it a municipal responsibility or a provincial responsibility to ensure municipalities can cover transport? Mm-hmm. And I'll just give you an example of where it gets a bit complicated. We had the response from somebody who needed to travel from the East Kootenays to their regional referral center, which happens to be in Cranbrook, which, as you know, is far away. It's about 6 hours of travel time. But more than that, it goes through several different municipalities to get from Golden to Cranbrook. Mm-hmm. So the narrative we had was around relying on municipal transport meant that they had to transfer their mechanism of transport three times.
Yikes.
So they had to find three different buses that would maybe not align perfectly in the time that they arrived and left. And the end of the story was what an arduous situation it was for the person trying to get from their home to access specialist services. And certainly, I think, you know, as a society, I think we'd all agree we can do better than that. How we do better than that, I think, is just in process. We're just starting to discuss that.
Okay. And which are these findings going to be brought to, let's say, the Ministry of Transportation or, you know, public health, et cetera, and maybe bring that question to the table, going, who wants to shoulder this burden?
Yeah, so we're working very closely with the Ministry of Health, and they're very interested in our findings, but you've made a really good point. This actually exceeds one ministry. It does involve transportation as well, and you know, some ministries responsible for municipal affairs as well. So I think that this is an instance where we really have to get everybody sitting around a table, because my experience, to tell you the truth, is that people are very interested in making sure that there is a social safety net. That's something that most people I talk to really pride themselves on, is our Canadian healthcare system, the fact that it doesn't depend on how much money you have or what access to resources you have. So there's an interest in figuring out how to get people from a low resource community or limited resource community to the care they need. We just quite don't know how yet.
And of course, if we had all these resources in our own towns, we wouldn't have to make all these trips. You know, for example, let's say I have a broken wrist. I can get it assessed at the hospital in town, but if I maybe need surgery, looks like I'm going to Trail. Is there maybe an option to get more professionals located in smaller communities? I know there's a lot of incentives for, let's say, nurses and medical professionals to come in terms of alleviation of their student debt, et cetera, et cetera. But you know what? What more can be done, do you think?
Yeah, so that's also an excellent question. And the challenge we have, of course, is low population density over a wide, vast geography. Mm-hmm. So when you have specialist care, you need a certain population threshold to make it worthwhile, because you're just focusing on one part, one disease characteristic.
Correct.
So rural healthcare thrives with really solid and effective generalist care. So family physicians, right? And in Creston, for example, you have, and in Golden and in Revelstoke and in Fernie, there's family physicians with enhanced surgical skills. So the family physicians might do clinic most of the time, but they can also be available to do low acuity or quite straightforward surgical procedures, which is a perfect model for low population density, but they do a wide range. So they might do hernia repair or appendectomies or cesarean sections. Once you start moving to a specialist model, you need a bigger population to support it. Mm-hmm. So when we look at, you know, equitable distribution of resources, it doesn't really make sense to put specialists or subspecialists in low volume or low resource community, low volume communities. But it does make sense to make better use of visiting specialists that come from the regional referral center and do a clinic in Creston or in Golden a day a month or whatever their schedule allows. And it does make sense to make use of virtual technology to link the local generalist physicians and nurses in with regional specialists to help them out and be able to provide guidance on what to do with the more difficult cases. So there's, I think, ways that the province and the health authority is looking at addressing the gap, but I actually don't think it makes a lot of sense to start putting specialists in small, low population communities.
Okay, so it sounds like we may have the option to use technology, but I remember this was back in, I think, 1999 or the year 2000. There was this giant book of assessing your medical needs that was handed out much like a phone book all over BC, and the elderly community kind of got mad at it, saying, like, you know, I need my doctor, I need to access medical care, how dare you just hand me this book, because, you know, there's a lot of people that go see a medical professional and maybe they didn't really have to in the first place. And they tore up these books saying this isn't enough. But, you know, having an iPad service going, hey, can you assess my cough? You know, do you worry that perhaps there could be a very similar sort of reaction to it?
Yeah, so that's very interesting. And I want to emphasize that I think in an ideal world, and I think what the evidence suggests is that virtual technology doesn't replace the relationship that you have, the interpersonal relationship you would have with your family physician. It augments it mm-hmm. with specialist input when needed. But just to get back to your point, your interesting example is that, you know, TELUS has come up with out with Babylon. And Babylon is online access to primary care physicians that anybody with MSP number can just log onto their computer and access. So I guess I would suggest the future is here. It is happening. Now, of course, you're going to be self-selected. For some people, that would be very attractive and a good thing to do. For others, in some populations, that would not be a good thing to do, or okay, it would not be preferable. So I think that, you know, there's going to be options and opportunities. What we need to remain, you know, keep at the center of this is we have to meet the needs of rural citizen patients in rural communities. And that means, you know, reflecting what they want and making available the kind of care that they want. So I think that we're never going to do away with the therapeutic relationship between a citizen patient and their primary care provider. We might want to do things to augment it, but that's going to be at the base of any healthcare plan, I think.
Okay, and I've got a question for our research coordinator, Christine.
Sarah Jensen, can I just add one thing onto that past point, though, before we move on? So I just want to just add that the two solutions that Jude mentioned, visiting specialists and telehealth, or the use of technology for delivering healthcare, those are both solutions that community members did share with us through the survey. And I just make that point because I think it shows the importance of asking community members and rural patients what they think they need and what they think their community can benefit from. It shows how in touch they are with their needs.
Okay, thank you. I imagine you've worked with other partners in this project, not just Jude. Could you maybe just give me a rundown of what sort of tools you implemented to kind of get this survey going and which partners you've worked with?
So in terms of the project team who's responsible for delivering the rural evidence review and within that, the survey, Jude and I are I would say, the two longstanding employees.
Okay.
An initiative that's, you know, run out of UBC, we are fortunate in that UBC has various programs that allow us to bring on students. So
okay,
those could be medical students or Masters of Public Health students, or just students who are looking to gain employment experience. So we've had quite a bit of experience having students on the project for 4 to 8 to 12 months at a time. But other than that, Jude and I are a mighty team of two.
There we go.
So in terms of rolling out the survey, we are the ones on the ground doing that. But I will add that the Rural Evidence Review Project has various advisory groups. So one of those groups is made up of policy and decision makers across the province. So those are representatives from the Ministry of Health, the regional health authorities, and First Nations Health Authority. But then we also have representation from rural clinicians on that committee as well. That committee, it was actually a member of that committee who initially flagged us to the potential of Facebook for outreach.
Okay.
So that's actually, you know, what I remember as kind of the starting point where we were like, oh, we could reach out to communities through Facebook pages. That's a great idea. And that from there, our engagement strategy kind of steamrolled. So that committee was involved in shaping our survey and outreach in that sense. And then the other committees that we have, which actually were developed alongside the survey. And it was again, out of this recognition that rural community members have a lot to say and want to be heard and, you know, would like their voice incorporated into the research and into health planning. So alongside the survey initiative, we developed what we've called rural citizen advisory committees. So we have three rural citizen advisory committees, which are groups of rural citizens from across BC, across rural communities in BC. We meet with each of the committees quarterly. And so we've had two quarterly groups of meetings, I guess you could say. And those committees are in place to give us feedback on the work of the project, including the survey, where we report back the findings of the survey and what we're learning through the project and hear their feedback on that and hear whether those findings resonate with them or if they have anything to add to that. And those committees also shape how we do our outreach. So we initially were only recruiting for a single committee, but we received such a high interest that we didn't want to turn anyone away. So once each committee reached about 10 to 12 members, we just created a new one. So that's why we have three. They're not necessarily divided or created according to geography or demographics. It was purely just that we wanted to hear anyone who wanted to be heard.
That's good. Jensen, mentioned. Yeah.
Can I just add something to that?
Yeah.
And it's reflected in the unanticipated enthusiastic response to the survey as well, but the committees too, is the absolute commitment that rural citizens have around contributing to healthcare planning, and how and their voice on the ground and their lived experience creates such wisdom. And it's just a delight to talk to people, but I can't understate or overstate, I guess. I can't overstate how impressive it is of people stepping up and sharing their viewpoints and their experiences through the survey, but also through these committees. The conversations are just phenomenal.
That's great. Now, just want to move on to one other point. As much as the province could use a nice, big, comfy blanket of support to improve conditions everywhere, have you kind of pinpointed maybe certain communities that could use more help, such as more remote communities, communities that are just harder to get to?
Yeah, so there are underserved communities, you know, relative to other communities of like size, like population and isolation for sure. But the interesting thing is that aside from a few really stable communities in terms of their health services complement, they're in flux. So all it takes in a lot of small communities is one person to become ill, mm-hmm. or one couple who decides to leave, and it sets everything. There's very little redundancy. So at any given time, there are a strata of communities that are fairly vulnerable, but they change. Quite frequently. And I think that that's part of the planning challenge.
Well, that actually recently happened in Nelson. We had like an eye care specialist retire, and it was like a trifecta of problems because, you know, Trail, Nelson, Creston, Cranbrook, not Cranbrook, Castlegar went, well, what now? What are we going to do? So they decided to do what I believe you mentioned earlier, is having a remote specialist visit communities in the meantime, because their permanent ophthalmologist decided to retire.
Yeah, exactly. And that happens frequently with all disease areas.
I could talk about this forever, I think, because the problems are not problems, but things that could possibly be improved are unending. But in this survey in particular, and especially for the East and West Kootenai, are there any specific things that you've pinpointed that would be an immediate, not easiest, but most effective way to improve healthcare services?
So one of the things that I'll point to is the challenge in the East Kootenays of no longer having ease of access to Alberta Health Services. So where historically citizens from the East Kootenays have frequently gone to Calgary or other places in Western Alberta, there's a slowdown on that, or the dissuasion of people going across the border for cross-border reasons. And it's created real challenges because what was a two-hour drive to Calgary is now a 5.5-hour drive to Cranbrook. So working through how we could acknowledge the reality of our provincial borders, but also support each other in access to health services, I think would be really, really important. And then right across the board, we have challenges recruiting and retaining healthcare providers, both physicians and nurses and allied health professionals in rural communities. And that's a big ticket item. That's one of those big questions that has to have lots of input to solve and has to happen from a provincial slash federal level to start having more incentives and more funding, I think. But it's something that is underscoring most of the challenges in rural communities.
Okay, I'd like to direct the same question to Christine.
Great. The first one that you mentioned about interjurisdictional travel, I would say is also the one that came to mind for me first. We also heard quite a bit from the East Kootenays and the Kootenays about the golden hour, and that's in the context of access to emergency care and emergency services, particularly after hours. And this idea of the golden hour for when you have a heart attack, it's the first 60 minutes of care that mm-hmm. is very important. And so I guess concern from community members that they won't be able to access care fast enough if they were to have a heart attack or some type of cardiac event. So that also comes to mind as something that I heard quite a bit. To speak to Jude's second point about challenges recruiting and retaining care providers across the spectrum of providers, one solution that was mentioned very often across the board was a need for walk-in clinics. So that also stuck out in my mind as something that we heard quite a bit.
Okay. If there's any last kind of closing statement you would like to share, by all means, now's your chance.
Yeah, so from my vantage point, just so much appreciation to our rural residents across BC for stepping up and sharing their healthcare experiences, but more than that, their solutions. And my fervent hope that decision makers and policymakers recognize the wisdom that we have in solving some of our problems and engage rural citizen patients.
Okay, and for you, Christine?
Whenever we do speak with local newspapers or local radio stations, this tends to be the final question. And I always like to end it by just expressing my gratitude and saying thank you so much to everyone for participating. We did not anticipate the response that we have received, but we feel really grateful that everyone who has taken the time to participate has done so. And to be a part of this movement, I suppose, toward improved rural healthcare.
And there we have it. I'd like to thank our guests from the Rural Evidence Review team, the principal investigator, Jude Cornelson, associate professor at the Department of Family Practice at the University of British Columbia, who's the co-director at the Center for Rural Health Research, and research coordinator, Christine Carthew, also at the Center for Rural Health Research at the Department of Family Practice at the University of British Columbia. Be sure to click on the link at mycrestonnow.com for all of the interesting facts and research and data collected through their survey, which is ongoing until the project's end in March 2021. I'm Jensen Shields, and thank you for listening.